I'm Ben Davies, and this is the Clear Money Mindset.
It's what we've been trying to educate our buyers on, especially first-time buyers, is sure, the interest rates are higher, but in the grand scheme of things, 5% is not an insane amount of interest to pay to borrow money. And yeah. Arguably, it's in a weird way, it's better to buy now than it was in the pandemic, because now you get to put conditions in again.
Welcome to the Clear Money Mindset, providing you with help and tips to manage your money in a clear and intentional way. I'm your host and financial advisor, Ben Davies. At Davies Financial Sterling Mutuals, we want to provide you with meaningful tips to help you with your money. Spring is here, and that typically means that things are getting busy in the real estate market. We wanted to give you a good picture of where the local real estate market is at, how things have changed in the last year or so, and some helpful information for those of you planning to participate in the real estate market this year, whether you're buying or selling. Today we're talking with Sebastian Schmoranz, a lawyer from Kingsville, Ontario. As someone who facilitates real estate transactions day in and day out, he offers a really good perspective on what's going on in the market. Not only is he knowledgeable, he's very entertaining. In this podcast, Sebastian gives some great information for those who are looking to buy or sell a home in this current market. All right, we are excited to have Sebastian Schmoranz. He's a lawyer out in Kingsville, Ontario. He's been on our podcast a couple of times, and we wanted to have him on to talk about the real estate market in 2024. And hopefully we get a good, clear picture of what's going on. Sebastian, it's so good to have you back on the podcast. Thanks for taking the time.
Ben, thanks for having me back.
No problem. I love the real estate conversation with a lawyer, because it's kind of like a middle ground. You can talk to a real estate agent or you can talk to an investor. People will have different opinions, but I would think in law, you're going to be a little bit agnostic to what the heck is going on in the market. So I wanted to ask you, just from your observation, what are some of the biggest changes you've noticed in the Windsor-Essex housing market as interest rates have gone up and inflation's gone up over the last couple of years? What are you seeing from your perspective?
So that's a great point. So I always view it as like bankers are the most conservative and realtors are the most over the top, and the real estate lawyers kind of fall somewhere in the middle in terms of where the real story lies. So a banker never wants to lend you money for your house, and a realtor always wants to oversell you on the house, and we kind of fall somewhere in the middle. But in terms of how it's changed, I think the biggest changes is obviously interest rates went up big time. And yep. But big time, I mean, if we look at it realistically compared to what a realistic real estate, like a mortgage rate is for a residential home compared to what maybe our baby boomer parents paid back in the 80s and 90s, we're still only paying between 5% and 7%, depending on where you're at. So it's,
we're doing
all
right.
Is it as good as 1.2? No, but is it in the grand scheme of things to borrow money to buy something as big and complicated as a house to live in, paying 5% to 7% is not the end of the world. In terms of how it's changed, the biggest way it's changed is obviously we've seen across the board prices have come down. Yep. I don't think they've come down as much as a lot of the naysayers were suggesting they would at the beginning of it. But in certain market sectors, they've come down a lot more. And in others, they've come down a little bit. So, for example, your stereotypical McMansion, so your stereotypical like big house on a tiny lot in a nice subdivision, has probably dropped more because it's harder to find a buyer for that type of house. But your average starter home and your average mid-range, the first step up from a starter home, or your semi-detached, they haven't really changed all that much in terms of pricing. You're still looking in the 380 to 520 range for those. That really hasn't gone anywhere. You still have a lot of bidding wars on those too, because that's really where most people start out. The main things we've seen change is you've got home inspections have come back in a big way again, because now you can finally put that in as a condition on your offer, because there are less offers now on a listing, and you can now as a buyer be a bit pickier and ask for more things that you want to see before you agree to sign on the dotted line. And the thing that I was preaching about the last time we talked is the financing condition. The financing condition is finally back, hallelujah, which means we don't have estate transactions anymore where people have overbid by a sizable margin. And then we go to the bank and the bank comes back and says, yeah, we'll lend you money, but you've got to come up with way more money on closing because we are only going to lend you 50, 60% of what you agreed to pay for this house. So I hope you can find that money on closing. So that has gone away and we are increasingly seeing it's got a financing condition and deals fall apart because it doesn't appraise at the right price or the client can't get financing or they do get financing and the purchase price is more in line with what a bank would actually give you to buy a house minus whatever your down payment is going to be.
Now, I know this wasn't on my question list, but I'm curious, has the commercial market been affected as much by this, especially because I've been thinking like maybe somewhere along the lines after COVID, people working from home more, hybrid working, maybe commercial gets hit a bit. What have you seen on your end there?
Commercial's kind of weird. It's hard to predict. I can tell you that. So like, for example, if we were in a large city like Toronto, where you've got large, sophisticated companies that have offered the hybrid work from home pattern. So like a lot of my colleagues on Bay Street still are being treated to the two or three days a week you can work from home thing. So I can tell you, I wouldn't want to be a large holder of commercial, especially office real estate in Toronto right now, because I think now that they've realized that, oh my God, I can run my company and I don't need to put them somewhere. And this real estate costs me a fortune to lease in Toronto every year. And I can probably get away with a space that's a quarter of the size. Like, I wouldn't want to be a real estate investor that had a whole pile of just office space, because my feeling is, you're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years, my guess is the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to see a lot of that get converted into condos, like residential, because they're going to say, screw it, there's no point. In the Windsor-Essex area, there was a decent amount of commercial real estate business because the federal government offered that tax refund on the purchase of commercial property in economically disadvantaged areas, which Windsor-Essex fell into that bracket. And you could get, I think, a tax refund of up to $90,000 back on the purchase of commercial property. It was on a sliding scale up to a certain price point, and don't quote me on the numbers. I think if you spent more than, I think it maxed out at $90,000 if you spent over $500,000, but don't quote me on that. The point being, I think a lot of people saw that as an opportunity to say, well, okay, I'll go ahead and buy it. It's commercial is always, and there always has been ebbs and flows. It just kind of depends on what you want to use commercial for. Like, do you want retail? Retail has taken a big hit post pandemic. So everybody can shop online now. Not all restaurants have properly rebounded. So like the commercial I would prefer is like professional offices. I have a massage therapist and she needs a space, or I have a chiropractor, or I have an eye doctor, or there's a daycare or an accounting office. Those are things where you're like, okay, so if I buy that building and I know that there are professional offices already in there, that's easy revenue and we'd be fine. But if it's like, I want to buy commercial and we're going to have a clothing store or a, I don't know, a restaurant or a bar, unless it's a long established existing thing, I feel like it's still really tough for a lot of our clients out there who are in those types of retail slash hospitality industries to rebound from that.
That makes space. That makes sense. It's pretty hard to be a chiropractor from home, right? That sounds like a sketchy business.
You need a table to put them on, and then you got to crack all sorts of parts of their body, and that's hard to do virtually. Unless you had a robot, which would be very scary, and I don't think you could convince somebody to lay down on a table with like a robot, you know, readjusting it.
Not yet. So for a long time, and you alluded to this, many were purchasing homes with no conditions at all. You already mentioned one change to that. But it might be good just to walk through what are some basic conditions you'd recommend people have when they're putting an offer on a home, especially I think everyone, at least many people I've talked to, there still feels this pressure that if a home comes up, you just got to figure out a way to get it. What would you say as far as conditions go that you'd say maybe non-negotiable, you need to put these on?
For sure. So I would say at the outset, so if you are in the mindset of I absolutely want a house and I don't care what I have to do to get it, then that's fine. But make sure you have money lined up from somewhere. So either you have the money or you've got a parent or a family member that's willing to give you that money. In which case, great. Find the thing you want. No conditions. Do what you got to do. And then that's okay. But if you don't have that, then we've seen the resurgence of the financing condition, which means the agreement is conditional on financing. So unless the bank goes out and appraises it and says, yeah, I think it's within the range of what you agreed to pay for it, we'll give you a mortgage, then you buy it. Otherwise, you have a way to walk away from the deal and say, no, I will not buy it. And the deal falls apart and you don't lose your deposit and everything's good. You've got home inspection. That's another condition that says, I'm not going to close on this deal until I have a chance to pick my home inspector and send them through this house. And they will give me a report. And I have to be satisfied with this report that the house is the way I want it to be. Otherwise, deal falls apart. Great. Yep. Other classic condition that's useful, especially for first-time home buyers, is usually most of our first houses are a fixer-upper of some kind. So either the house is a disaster or the house is a rental, which means there's tenants in there. And tenants have been still the biggest problem in Ontario, and the Ontario government has still failed miserably in cleaning up the backlog at the Landlord-Tenant Board. So you definitely want to, especially in this market, if the house you want to live in happens to be currently used as a rental, you definitely want to put in a condition that says, we will not close until that house is vacant, because you don't want, and I saw it happen with people who did not put that condition in the last 4 or 5 years. You buy a house that has tenants in it and you didn't want the tenants because you want to move in the house. And now you're stuck trying to evict these people. And I can tell you the backlog at the LTB is still 6 to 9 months if you're lucky. And it doesn't mean that the decision's going to go your way and you're paying a mortgage on a house that has people in it that you don't want in there. So those are the kinds of conditions you really want to see depending on the nature of the property you want to buy. Now, commercial is different, industrial is different, multi-residential is different. But for a house you want to live in, you want at least financing and you want at least home inspection. And if you know from the listing that there's tenants living in the house, I want clear proof that they have been evicted and they are gone prior to closing, because otherwise you're inheriting a giant problem.
So 6 to 9 months just to get in front of a representative, or I don't even, judge isn't the right word, but
they're not, it's an administrative tribunal. So you have, it's run by a panel and they're called members. And the issue is, and has always been the case, it is horrifically underfunded. And unless this has changed recently, Windsor Essex doesn't even have its own Landlord-Tenant Board. It's all run out of London. So they only send people down so and so many times a month. So take that into account as well. And the backlog in terms of even getting a hearing, and then the backlog of after the hearing's done, getting a decision. And then the law is designed to protect tenants, not landlords. So then we give all the tenants, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, second tries to solve the problem and to get out of it. And it's just, it's not effective. And it's not that I'm anti-tenant. It's just that the whole system is broken in general. Because even if you were a tenant and you wanted to go after your landlord because your landlord's failing to repair the unit or do something, that the reality is you can't get it resolved by the panel in a reasonable amount of time, which is why you keep seeing these stories out in the news of cash for keys, right? Where landlords are literally saying, I will write you a check right now if you promise to leave. Can you please just leave? Because if I have to litigate this through the tribunal, there's no point, right?
Yeah.
And that's not what should be happening, but is the reality of probably what the best option is right now.
Yeah, I went through that years ago and it wasn't that busy and backed up. And it's very surprising how long someone can live in a place with paying $0 before you can actually legally get them out if it was working on a normal day. It was almost a year process then.
Yes. And that's Look, I get it. I understand. We don't want to throw people out on the street. We don't want to make people homeless. I understand that there's an argument to be made that all of us have a human right to some sort of a roof over our heads. That's totally fair. But I think, especially in the world we're in now with interest rates being so high, there's a ton of landlords out in our listening community right now that are probably paying astronomical mortgages. And the rent doesn't come anywhere close to covering the cost of carrying that house. So they're losing money every month. And then you finally find someone who's going to buy the house and you're so happy that you finally get to offload this dog of a bad investment. And you can't because you have no mechanism for getting rid of the tenant that's sitting in there. And that's a problem, right? And it's, I don't know what the answer is, but it's clear to everybody who is even remotely involved with this industry that the landlord-tenant board is broken and it just doesn't work. And it's probably like... We feel a lot of calls every month at our firm from landlords and from tenants who are frustrated and upset that they're not getting answers. And that's got to mean something. That's got to be a sign of an underlying issue that needs to be resolved, but it clearly hasn't been.
Sure. Now, what about the reverse? So the market, the condition you should put on if you're buying, I would just say the market has changed the most for a seller.
We're seeing listings sitting longer on average. It appears that they are sitting on the market longer. Like it used to be, like in the height of pandemic insanity, I mean, a realtor could barely get a sign knocked into a front lawn before the house was sold. So those days are gone. It's kind of back to what it was in 2016, 17, 18, which was properties will sit for a couple weeks, which is kind of the way it was supposed to be. I mean, I like it because realtors have to work for their money now. They have to actually do open houses again. Open houses used to be a thing. That's how you sold a house. You had to actually go out and put out some coffee and cake and some beverages and be like, please come and walk through this house and I will show it to you and let me know if you'd like to make an offer. People literally were buying houses based on one grainy picture on realtor.ca, which is a nightmare, right? So it's gone back to pre-pandemic days, which is you list a house. It sits for a couple of weeks, maybe a month or two. You have a couple open houses. People come through. They make offers. All the offers have conditions. Are there bidding wars? Yeah, there might be, but it's not like, I think at the height of the pandemic, we were doing deals where like houses sold for like $200,000 to $300,000 over asking, which was just insanity. Now we're back to like, yeah, it might sell for like $50,000 to $125,000 over asking, which like, still is too much, but is still like, but even that it's sold for $125,000 we're asking with conditions. So it's not like somebody just rolls in and throws cash at the problem and says, I'm going to overpay for the sake of overpaying. So I think that's been a good thing. I think, as a seller, if you were hoping you were going to make a bonanza on your house, you're probably a year too late now, because I think the end of that bonanza was spring of last year. That was really the beginning of the end because the interest rates kept going up, 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 up. And that's kind of when people keep saying the bottom fell out of the market. The bottom didn't fall out of the market in Windsor Essex. Sure, other part, like around the GTA, yes. But down here, it's just things adjusted and they went down somewhat. And it's just you didn't have, you know, 20 people bidding on one house at increasingly exorbitant prices with no conditions. Now it's like, sure, I really want this house. I'll bid another 10 grand, but I still have the same two conditions in there. So, but so does everybody else who's bidding on the house. So it's, I'm not saying it sucks for a seller. In a weird way, it's probably less stressful for a seller now because you don't have to wade through 30 offers on one listing. You probably only have 10 or 8 or 6, which is kind of nice. Sure. I mean, would I have preferred to be a seller in 2021, 2022? Sure. But like, I also kind of like that it's not, because I had listing agents that were calling me being like, I don't know how to deal with the number of offers I just got on this house because it's like astronomical. How do I respond to all these people and what do we do? Like it was an unheard of before problem down here.
Well, and it's kind of, I think it's a nice thing in the sense that like a home's a pretty big deal. Everyone's got a gun to their head to like make it happen fast. That's not good for the market. It's not good for the buyer or seller. I think it, hopefully people are getting a better idea of what they're actually purchasing now. And then the seller's got a more realistic idea of what their home's actually worth. And I think you want a market working that way, where you're getting close to like fair market value. Like you want to be buying what you're buying and not paying a bunch of extra because of there's hype, or you feel like, you know, you're worried and it's just like, well, let's bid what we can. Who cares if it's worth that? It's not how you want a free market working. And that's how bubbles burst and people lose money. So,
and that's the thing. To me, it's like the fair came back into fair market value of what the properties were down here. Like, do I think we had a bubble down here? I don't think we had a bubble. I think we might have had a bubble in certain types of listings, like the ones that were in the $800,000 to $1 million range, because yep. Some of those were selling for prices that made no sense. But a lot of the buyers were cash buyers, generally speaking, rich boomers or city people that had sold in the GTA. And for them, that was play money and they overspent down here. And that's their problem. They weren't getting mortgages. But I think generally speaking, in the average type home, your 380 to 520 range, some of them were overcooked. And now things have slowed down. People have more time to educate themselves and think about, do I even want to buy this house? Inspect things a little bit more. And I agree, it's become fairer. Now, if you were a brutal ultra capitalist as a seller, you'd be like, well, I wish it was still like 2021, 2022. Sure, fair. But yeah. At the same time, I think, look, I'm glad that we didn't have a ginormous bubble that burst and we have, you know, hundreds of people that are upside down in their mortgages and there's all sorts of problems. Like it's just things got heated and things cooled a bit. But it's not extreme. It's not like, you know, properties lost, you know, 60-70% of their value. No, I don't think anybody lost value necessarily, other than a handful of cash buyers that bought luxury things down here. I think it's largely things slowed down and things don't have quite the crazy bidding wars anymore. And you have fewer people bidding. There are more conditions on everything. So it's just, everything's a bit safer now. And in a weird way, it's what we've been trying to educate our buyers on, especially first-time buyers, is sure, the interest rates are higher, but in the grand scheme of things, 5% is not an insane amount of interest to pay to borrow money. And arguably, it's in a weird way, it's better to buy now than it was in the pandemic, because now you get to put conditions in again, which I especially want first-time buyers having lots of conditions, because like, this is your first time doing this. It's a big deal and it's expensive and it's complicated. And we don't want you to feel rushed and we don't want you to feel bullied into something or pressured into something. And it gives you lots of outs and it gives you lots of abilities to educate yourself and be like, oh, the house has Kitech plumbing, or oh, the foundation is leaking and I don't like that. And you'd be like, well, great. You can absolutely walk away and you get your deposit back and go pick something else. And or think about it. Say, okay, maybe I do still want it, but maybe we can negotiate a reduction in price and still close. Like, that hasn't been a thing for 3 years. I haven't had to negotiate anything on a real estate deal for 3 years because it's just been like, well, screw it. We paid 80 over asking or 180 over asking and we're closing and don't ask any questions. Okay, go for it.
Well, I was talking to somebody today. They were getting some appraisals done and they were telling me that there's a long line. This particular person who does appraisals, it was like, I think a 6 week wait time, something close to that. And I'm like, well, that's a good sign because that means people or banks at least are more interested in knowing what exactly are we putting our money behind. And that can't be anything but healthy.
It's a great hint to your listeners. If your kids don't know what they want to do for a living, tell them to go out and get certified as a real estate appraiser, not a realtor. There you go. Become a real estate appraiser. You will work for the rest of your life because those people work nonstop. Because the banks don't care what a realtor thinks. The bank cares what a certified real estate appraiser thinks that the house is worth. And if until that appraisal comes in, nobody gets any money. So it's a great business to be in.
Yeah. So I want to move to the investment side of things because I think there's a few things. I'm not a real estate guy, and I just look at some of the economic conditions, and I wonder like what the long term is on things like that. But it seems like there's a few headwinds that are there that weren't before. Like it's a weird thing. You have it becoming harder to get a good home. You have cost of living going way up. So the people generally who are looking to pay rent have less money to pay rent with. But at the same time, you have real estate prices that are higher. So it takes more capital to get into the market in the first place. So I think those would be some things just at a basic level without like having much of a brain towards real estate. You would say, okay, that seems like you're going to have to be a lot more careful in how you pick a building as an investor. But what would you say? Do you think market conditions now have made it harder for investors? And do you have any tips for investors that are looking to get into the investment property market? And I guess if we're focused on residential, you have the flipping side or the renting side. But what would you say people should be more cautious of now if they're looking to get in as an investment?
So I think renting is still a good idea. I think flipping has gotten more challenging, and I have a feeling it's going to get even more challenging because CRA is getting pickier and pickier about how they are going to tax you on flipping. Because the way you used to flip, which always worked well, which has always been legal, so I'm not saying anything that's illegal, was
sure.
I'm a flipper, I buy a house, and I declare it as my principal residence on my tax return, and I repair this house. And then within 6 months, I sell this house again. And because you have your principal residence exemption, assuming it's not worth $50 million, you don't pay any capital gains tax. And then you buy the next one, and you do it over and over and over and over again. And they have been tightening up and tightening up and tightening up and tightening up on those rules. So I think we are going to get to a place where essentially the only house flippers who are going to succeed are the people who run it the same as a contractor would run a business, which is we buy properties, we fix them up, and we sell them on the open market, and we pay all the taxes associated with that, which is fine. You have to be bigger and more established. It can't just be like me and my wife are handy and we want to do this and make a whole pile of money, because you used to be able to. It's not as lucrative. Unless, of course, you still have to look at the underserviced markets in this area, which is like Tilbury is still pretty affordable. Chatham is still pretty affordable. Wheatley, Blenheim area is still pretty affordable. Sarnia is still pretty affordable. But again, you got to live there, or you got to be handy, or you got to know which property to buy that isn't a dumpster fire and fix it up and flip it and sell it. And now the taxation part of it gets more challenging. Now, renting. Renting is still good. Rent rates I wish I would have had my stats with me. I don't have them in front of me. But rent prices are still up in across Windsor Essex. I think, and I could be wrong, I think the average in Windsor now for like a one bed in Windsor, and Windsor is lower than the county. That's what people don't understand. Rent prices are higher in the county than they are in the city because the city has more supply. There's more rental units to pick from, which drives down the cost of renting. I think a one bed, and don't quote me, but I think a one bed now in the city, I think the average price is somewhere around $1,200 or $1,300 a month. But I can tell you that the equivalent in the county is at least 1500, if not more.
Really?
Well, because there's less supply, so there's more demand. So, hey, I want to live out in the county with my family and I can't afford to own and I have to rent. I mean, like houses in Kingsville rent for between, you know, $1,800 and $2,500 a month. And they do as well in Leamington and the other surrounding towns. It just depends, right? It depends on the market, supply and demand. Now, so I want to become a real estate investor. There are still great opportunities. The issue, of course, is you have to put a larger down payment down if you're buying it as an investment. And with the way prices are, you have to kind of look at one of two options. So either you're going to buy it and rent it out and do all the repairs yourself. If you can do that, great, then that means that you can probably afford to buy in at a higher price. If you're like me and you only know how to build IKEA furniture, then you wanna buy something that's as cheap as possible because you're gonna have to hire contractors to fix stuff so that you can rent it out, right? So then you have to look at, you know, the cheaper parts of Windsor, or you have to look at Tilbury, or you have to look at Chatham. You can't buy a building lot in the county in most places for less than $200,000 now. So like I can't buy a starter home for less than $400 now, pretty much. Now in Windsor, you still have opportunities in the 300s. So if you're an investor out there and you're like, I'd like to buy myself a rental house, I would say you have one of two choices. Either buy as close to the college and university as possible and rent it out by the room and make a whole pile of money, but understand that once a year you have to fix that entire house because you have 18, 19, and 20-year-olds living in there who will destroy the place. Or don't buy near there, pay a little bit more money and find families or professionals or people to rent to who might even pay you. They won't pay you more rent than the buy the room rate, because buy the room rentals is, you know, a pile of money, but it's also a pile of cost in terms of repairs. Whereas like the, you know, we're going to rent out a whole, like you could take a 3-bedroom house and rent it out by the room at the university. You could take a 3-bedroom house and just rent it out as a 3-bedroom house, which is less money, but you end up with hopefully a family and who aren't crazy and who aren't having keg parties in there every other weekend and setting the place on fire. So that's cost benefit analysis, right? Or you go to a place like Chatham. Chatham is still very much up and coming. Chatham still has a lot of affordable real estate. It's still possible to buy dwellings in Chatham that are under $300,000, which is wild. It still exists. It's a thing. Now they need a lot of TLC. But if you and a buddy know how to paint and do basic drywall repairs, and you know, you buy a couple of used appliances off of Facebook Marketplace and you stick them in there and you find yourself a good blue collar family who just needs a place to rent and they're honest, hardworking people and they pay the rent, then you know, that's your return on investment there. And Chatham properties will appreciate in value. They don't appreciate as quickly as Windsor Essex properties do, but they still appreciate and it is going in the right direction. And you can still get in at a reasonably low cost of entry.
Okay, cool. Before we shift topics, this is kind of a general question. When people are looking at buying a home and they're getting their realtor or they're getting a lawyer, what's a good realistic idea of how a lawyer is involved in the whole process and what things that, aside from just saying, call Sebastian Smorans, what are some things that they should really make sure they're getting out of a lawyer as far as their role in the whole process?
That's fair. So is your lawyer willing to meet you at home? Is your lawyer willing to meet you outside of office hours? Is your lawyer capable of having virtual appointments with you? Because most of us work, you know, most married couples, both husband and wife, work, and they can't take time off work to come and sit in a stuffy lawyer's office and sign boring paperwork. Your lawyer's job is to do a title search to make sure that the stuff that you think you're buying is actually what you think you're buying, and that there aren't easements or other restrictions or leases or boundary disputes or other problems or debts registered against title. Your lawyer's job is to deal with your bank and your real estate agent to make sure that everything goes smoothly on closing. Where are the keys? Did we do a final walkthrough? Is there something wrong with the house that needs to be fixed? Did the people you're buying from not clean everything out? Is something broken? Does the bank require all sorts of weird stuff to be completed prior to closing? How are they going to fund the mortgage? Are we getting a home equity line of credit? So we're getting a mortgage portion to buy the house, and we're also getting a line of credit because we're going to do renovations. Do we want to draw money on that line of credit immediately? Those are kind of the basic things. And my view has always been, yes, there are cheaper and more expensive lawyers out there. You get what you pay for. And my argument has always been, if you want someone to pick up the phone when you call because something has gone wrong, or if you want someone to be proactive in solving a problem for you as they arise, you need to pay them enough money to care. And I know that we all live in an economy of extreme inflation right now, and it's not cheap to do anything, but if you are going to live in a house, which is probably the most important investment you will ever make, do we really want to take the cheapest option that exists out there, or do we want to spend a little bit more money and hire somebody who cares? And all I care about is that you want to hire somebody who cares about it and who you can reach and who you can talk to on the phone. So my thing has always been, I don't charge by the phone call. I don't charge by the email. I don't, like, if you want to call me 65 times on your real estate transaction, you can. And if something goes wrong, I will take the time to fix it. And because you pay me enough to care, and it sounds really crass to say, but there are a lot of lawyers out there that will advertise a flat fee for this, and it's, we're the cheapest this and we're the cheapest that. Well, yeah, and so is a McDonald's cheeseburger. So do you want the McDonald's cheeseburger of real estate transactions, or do you want something that's a little bit better? Because it's the place you're going to rest your head at night. It's the place you're going to live in. It's a huge investment. This isn't like buying a new pair of socks at the Gap. Like, this is a big deal. So all I'm saying is, I don't care if you hire me or if you hire any of the colleagues at my firm. I would love you to, but if not, that is okay. I care that you take the time to research who actually takes the time to meet with clients, talk to clients, respond to their concerns, and care. Not just who is the cheapest option that exists on the face of the earth. And I think there's this misnomer that has come out, especially since the pandemic, especially since everybody's been offering things virtually, of like, oh, we're the discount, low cost, insert service here, and everything is super easy and cheap. Yeah, but what if they do a really crappy job and then something goes wrong and you have to call them and nobody answers the phone, or you get rerouted to a call center and then you sit on hold for 3 hours? Like, is that really, are you saving money there? Yeah, it costs you less upfront, but in terms of time and service, did you get anything out of it, right?
Yep. Well, that's a good point. And you want really the best time to solve a problem is before the transaction's finished. And most people aren't going to know all of the things to look for. So I like that. A good mix of check out the experience, but make sure you're not going after the lawyer that's going to get you done in with the least amount of money as possible. You're probably going to pay for that in the end.
I will say, so Google reviews are a great thing, but I will say the funny thing about being a lawyer is we fall in like the same category as like used car salesmen. So people generally tend to hate us, even if we do nice things. So I would point out, don't make your lawyer hiring decision on Google reviews alone, because a lot of people just like to write mean, nasty reviews about us because they hate lawyers. And that's okay. I would suggest, you know, ask your realtor, ask your banker, ask your financial advisor, ask a friend who's just bought or sold a house. Who did they use? Who did they like? And go based on that. But I mean, the point being is, I don't care if you hire our firm, it'd be great if you did. But if not, that's fine. Please just take the time at least, because it blows my mind the number of clients that I hear experiences about where it was like, well, we never even thought about that. And I'm like, well, it's a really important part of this transaction. And wouldn't you... like, what if something goes wrong? Like, and I'm not saying this to be mean, but on closing day, if something goes wrong, your banker and or mortgage broker and your realtor cannot help you. You are now in the hands of your lawyer. So if you randomly picked a lawyer out of the phone book who had the cheapest rate and doesn't care, good luck. And if you picked one who you actually had a conversation with who cares, you can call that person and they'll answer and they'll be like, hey, what can we do? And how can we help? And how can we jump in and solve this problem for you? Like I do everything I can on a file when something goes wrong. And so does my partner, Amy Lynn Hart. And so does my associate, Peggy Golden. And so does my associate, Aaron Pervin, to ensure that if something goes wrong, someone is going to fix this problem for you. Because A, you paid us enough money that we should definitely care. And B, we set up our firm in such a way that we need to care, because that's the whole point. You're going to live there. You're going to sleep there tonight. And we got to make sure that we get you so that you can sleep there tonight. And not like 3 minutes to midnight, you finally move in. Like, we'd like to have you in by 3 o'clock in the afternoon so that you're unpacking in daylight and not in pitch black darkness.
Nice. Well, I like that answer. That's cool. So that's a great overview of the real estate market.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, financial, or professional advice. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and are for informational purposes only and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of Sterling Mutuals Inc. Mutual funds and ETFs provided through Sterling Mutuals Inc. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses all may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts before investing. Mutual funds are not guaranteed, their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated.